Shalom, Hadavarnix. Well, we're ready to start our 42nd session of the First Regathering Modern Israel. This will be found on page 374 of your notebook, page 374. All right, let's review where we were last session. Last session, we saw that the Hezbollah terror chief Imad Mughniyeh was assassinated in Damascus, but unfortunately, terror chiefs can be replaced, and Hezbollah continued, of course. A very serious event that happened in our last session was the bombing of Ami Oritz. It was Purim, and 15-year-old Ami picked up a Purim, or what he thought was a Purim present, on the front porch, or front door of their family's home. When he opened it up, it exploded in his face, sending him to the hospital with very serious injuries. Here is a picture of Ami on the left, Leah, his mom, in the middle, and David, his father, on the right. And it was thought that this is not an attempt to kill a 15-year-old, but probably an attempt to kill David Oritz because he's a messianic pastor in Israel. So that was probably the motivation behind this. After a long investigation, well, by the way, bombing was covered very sympathetically in the newspapers in Israel. And this is one of those newspaper articles with David and Ami in the hospital. After a long investigation, eventually Yaakov Jack Teitel was arrested, and finally he was sentenced to two life terms, not necessarily for the attempt on Ami's life, which he was charged with, but for other killings that he had perpetrated in the past. He was a serial killer. So this is the man that tried to kill David Oritz. We also learned that for the first time in 2,000 years, Levites gathered and were being fitted for the Levitical garments, the garments that they would wear to function in the sacrificial system, to oversee the sacrificial system in the temple when it gets rebuilt. So that is underway by the Temple Institute. The Interior Ministry decided to get very, very strict on their visa applications. And so many workers in Israel suddenly found themselves told to leave the country because their visas would not be renewed. Now, Josh and Irena experienced that as well. Their visas would not be renewed. They could not get back in the country, and they have still not been able to get back into the country as of 2015, so they are ministering in the Czech Republic at this time. So this has affected Hadavar as well. The sixth president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, came to the UN and lambasted Israel in no uncertain terms. President Barack Obama was elected in the United States by an amazing 78% of the Jewish vote. 78% of the Jewish vote voted for him. Unwittingly, they were voting in the most anti-Israel president in the current days. He has proved definitely to be the most anti-Israel president we've had in recent times. Rockets began to fall in southern Israel with regularity. Over 800,000 people were affected. We saw that rockets were fired into Ashdod and into Ashkelon. Another major city to receive rocket fire was Be'er Sheva. This is the first time rockets had landed in Be'er Sheva. Be'er Sheva is quite a distance from the Gaza Strip, 40 kilometers, but the Hamas has increased the range of their rockets. So now even Be'er Sheva came under attack. Gadara, also in that range. So these are some of the major cities and areas that received rocket fire. This is the Eshkol region in this particular area here. So rocket fire increased, not only in the south, but also in the north. Here is a map of Israel. And Nahariya received rocket fire from Lebanon, and also Kiryat Shmona, Hezbollah in Lebanon, firing rockets into northern Israel. This led to Operation Cast Lead, an assault to try to stop this rocket fire. The initial assault targets of Operation Cast Lead were Gaza City, and down south of the Gaza Strip, Khan Yunis, and Rafah on the very border of the Gaza Strip. An attempt to try and stop this rocket fire. It did not succeed. Terrorism continued. For example, this individual commandeered this bulldozer and attacked the bus in the foreground, knocking it over. And then he went after a police car as well before he was shot to death. So this was a rather unique attack using this piece of heavy equipment. Well, the UN wanted to investigate Operation Cast Lead, so they created a fact-finding mission on the Gaza War. And the leader of the UN fact-finding mission was a Jewish man from South Africa, Richard Goldstone. His report was totally dismissed by the U.S. House of Representatives. The Hurva Synagogue was rebuilt. Here's a picture of the Hurva Synagogue in 1930. It was a major synagogue in the Jewish world in those days. However, it was destroyed in 1948 when the Jordanians captured the old city. In 1967, when Israel recaptured the West Bank and the old city, they decided to create this memorial arch for the Hurva Synagogue. And this is the way I saw the Hurva when I was first in Israel. We walked in those ruins, and this arch was very prominent in the old city. But eventually, around 2000, resources gelled to rebuild the synagogue, and in 2010, the synagogue was reopened and rededicated. So here's the Hurva Synagogue in the old city of Jerusalem as it looks today. A very beautiful building on the outside and also on the inside. I have not had the privilege of being on the inside of this building, but I have been able to see it from the outside. It is hoped that this synagogue will become a major synagogue in Jewish life again. The Mavi Marmara led a convoy of boats to try and break Israel preventing supplies from getting into the Gaza port. And I'll remember the word here eventually. And this map in your blockade, there it is, the Gaza blockade. The incident led to some violence. This is the Mavi Marmara, the lead ship of that convoy. And the result was when they refused to go to Israel and unload their cargo there, and the Israelis commandeered the ships, the result was 7 peace activists killed and a number of Israeli soldiers injured. And that brings us now to 2011. We've just finished up 2010, and let's begin 2011. 2011 will be on page 374 of your notebook. We'll begin in March. We'll begin in March with the Itamar massacre. 2 Palestinians infiltrated the town of Itamar and murdered 5 members of the Fogel family in their beds. Among the victims were 3 young children, including an infant. And here's a picture of the Fogel family, mother and father at the top, and the 3 young boys that were murdered in their beds on the bottom. Takes a pretty courageous terrorist to murder 3 young children in their beds, doesn't it? Pretty disgusting and sad. Very sad event in the life of Israel. Let's move to March 23rd, 2011. The Jerusalem bus stop bombing. Hamas bombs a bus station in Jerusalem and kills 1 civilian, injures 39. All right, turn to page 375. We'll move into April. April 7th, 2011, Hamas attacks a school bus. Hamas militants bombed an Israeli school bus and killed a teenager. Again, takes a lot of bravery to shoot a rocket at a school bus full of children, doesn't it? Well, bravery isn't the issue. The issue here, of course, is terrorism. And the issue here is that any Jew, the only good Jew, is a dead Jew, whether it be a child or an adult. They don't care. That's the way the terrorists operate. That's the Hamas mindset. All right, August 18th, southern Israel cross-border attacks. Egyptian and Palestinian militants attack southern Israel and kill 8 Israelis, including 6 civilians. 40 are injured. 5 Egyptian soldiers are also killed. So Hamas, it will go after Egyptians as well, starting in August of 2011. September 2011, the Palestinian Authority moves a resolution in the UN for recognition of the Palestinian statehood, calling it the Palestine Spring. We're going to become a state, be recognized by the UN. Well, this resolution went nowhere in September 2011. Then we move to October, and we come on the 18th to the Gilad Shalit prisoner exchange. The Gilad Shalit prisoner exchange followed an agreement between Israel and Hamas to release Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit in exchange for 1,027 prisoners, mainly Palestinians and Arab Israelis. Although among the prisoners released, there was also a Ukrainian prisoner, a Jordanian prisoner, and a Syrian prisoner. So one Israeli soldier for 1,027 prisoners. That created some interesting, or produced some interesting cartoons in the media. Here is a cartoon, Gilad Shalit against 1,027 Palestinians. And here are the terrorists leaving leaving their imprisonment, going into the Gaza Strip. And this one man is contemplating his worth compared to an Israeli soldier. He said, "I did the math. I'm worth 70 grams of an Israeli soldier. I'm not even worth one Israeli soldier." 280 of these prisoners were sentenced to life in prison. So these are serious guys. 280 of these prisoners have been sentenced to life in prison for planning and perpetrating various terror attacks against Israeli targets. These were the most serious prisoners that were released. Dry Bones had his say in this too. He came, he waded into the issue here with this cartoon. He called it the Palestinian Pyramid Scheme. Pyramid Scheme. One terrorist says to the other, "You want to kidnap dozens more Israeli hostages? Yes. And we'll have the manpower to do it once they release hundreds of convicts in return for the one hostage we're now holding. Wow. No wonder they call you slick. Thanks." So I then appear the Dry Bones thinks very much of releasing 1,027 prisoners for one Israeli soldier. So the exchange raised controversy in Israel. Hamas military leader Ahmed Yabari was quoted in the Saudi Arabian newspaper Al Hayat as confirming that the prisoners released as part of the deal were collectively responsible for the killing of 569 Israeli civilians. So the majority of these people are guilty of 569 murders. The agreement came 5 years and 4 months after Palestinian militants captured Shalit in southern Israel along the Gaza border. So Gilad had been in prison now in confinement captivity 5 years. 5 years and 4 months. That's a long time. The deal, brokered by German and Egyptian mediators and coordinated by, and I can't read that word, German political agent Gerhard Conrad, was signed in Egypt on the 11th of October 2011. The first phase was executed on the 18th of October 2011, with Israel releasing 477 Palestinian prisoners and Hamas transferring Shalit to Cairo. In the second phase, which took place in December of 2011, another 550 prisoners were released. The agreement is the largest prisoner exchange agreement Israel has ever made. Given that as part of the agreement, Israel agreed to release 1,027 prisoners for one captured Israeli soldier, the highest price Israel has ever paid for a single soldier. In addition to that, Gilad Shalit was also the first captured Israeli soldier to be released alive in 26 years. It is the grace of God that he got out of there alive. And here is a picture of Gilad Shalit as he got off the helicopter and was greeted by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So the country rejoiced when Gilad was free. All right, let's jump to November 2011. This is on page 376. Palestine wins membership in UNESCO. While the UN vote on statehood is put off amid no support from France and the UK, United Kingdom, and the US threatened to veto it. All right, moving on. We're now in 2012, page 376. We begin January 1st, right, the first day of 2012. Gaza fires two white phosphorus-containing mortars into the area governed by the Eshkol Regional Council. The shells landed in an open field and caused no injuries or damage, but these are a military weapon being fired against civilians. Hey, this is a serious violation of international law. A military weapon fired against civilians. So a complaint about the white phosphorus was subsequently sent to the UN by Israel. All right, from March 9 through 15, 2012, we have the Gaza-Israel clashes. Gaza militants launch over 300 rockets, Grad missiles, and mortar shells into southern Israel, wounding 23 Israeli civilians. And you have this map on page 377 of your notes. And again, it shows you the extent of the Hamas rocket threat in March of 2012. Their most powerful rocket can reach beyond Tel Aviv, all the way up to Herzliya, and well past Beersheba now. So Hamas has been definitely upgrading their rocket arsenal. Israel retaliates with airstrikes on Gazan weapons storage facilities, rocket launching sites, weapons manufacturing facilities, training bases, posts, tunnels, terror operatives, killing 22 militants. Four Palestinian civilians died during the clashes, although some of their deaths were found to be unrelated to Israeli actions. All right, end of March, March 30. It was revealed that the civil administration, a unit of the IDF, had over the years covertly earmarked 10% of the West Bank for further settlement. So yes, Israel would like to expand into the West Bank if they possibly can. That is the historical homeland of the Jewish people. Let's jump all the way to September 21, 2012. September 2012, Egyptian-Israel border attack. Militants open fire on Israeli soldiers and civilian workers. One soldier is killed. So along the Egyptian border, south of Gaza, there is a terrorist attack. Let's move to November. November 14th through 21. Operation Pillar of Defense. The Israeli Air Force kills Ahmed Jabari, second in command of the military wing of Hamas. So the second in command is assassinated. Here is Ahmed Jabari. We'll learn more about him in just a few seconds. He deeply hated Israel. And the IDF publicized what they did. Here is an infrared camera in Gaza. And the car in the circle is Jabari's car. And the IDF fired one rocket at that car, hit it point blank. He fired one rocket when there was no civilian citizens around for collateral damage, and this was the result. There's the car, and you can see there is nothing left in the inside. The passengers in that car were vaporized from the force of that explosion, and that car was turned into a pile of rubble, what's left of it. So it was a pinpoint strike against this military leader of Israel. And was executed very, very successfully. Again, it's another example of where Israel does their very, very best not to incur civilian casualties, but only military casualties. Israel then struck at 1,500 sites in Gaza, including rocket launch pads, weapons depots, government facilities, and apartment blocks. Now, you have this list on page 377, 1,500 terror targets. And as you read the terror targets that are hit there in the list, for example, 980 underground rocket launchers, 140 smuggling tunnels, 66 tunnels used for terrorist operations. We see that Gaza is an armed camp. Hamas has turned Gaza into an armed camp. It is not a city. It is a military base. Gaza officials said 133 Palestinians had been killed in this conflict, of whom 79 were militants, 53 civilians, one a policeman, and an estimated 804 Palestinians wounded. Hamas fires over 1,456 rockets at southern Israel, killing six, including a pregnant woman, and injuring hundreds. Rockets fired at Jerusalem for the first time and at Tel Aviv for the first time since the first Gulf War. A bus is bombed in Tel Aviv on November 21st, wounding 28 civilians, page 377. Israel retaliates by bombing hundreds of military sites in the Gaza Strip. See, all this is perpetrated by Jabari as Hamas's military commander since 2002. Some authorities state second in command. Jabari was responsible for the planning and execution of countless acts of terrorism against Israelis, like the ones we've just mentioned. In 1996, he was involved in bombings that killed 59 Israeli civilians. In 1998, he helped execute a terror attack on a school bus in Kfar Darom that killed two Israeli children. And in 2006, Jabari organized the terror squad that infiltrated southern Israel, killed three IDF soldiers, and kidnapped Gilad Shalit. Following his involvement in the October 2011 prisoner exchange with Israel, Jabari became the de facto leader of Hamas, and Israel attempted to work with him behind the scenes to bring calm to the region. Instead, Jabari remained committed to the Hamas agenda of destroying Israel, and he ordered, or he permitted, a new barrage of rockets to be fired at Israel. So you see why the Israeli Defense Forces decided that this is one guy that needs to be taken out. He was definitely upping the ante there, attacking Israel more and more. Well, what were Israel's objectives for Operation Pillar Defense? Like other nations, Israel maintains its right to self-defense against threats to its civilian population. According to Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak, the IDF has four main goals for the current operation, for Operation Pillar Defense. One, A, to strengthen Israel's military deterrence over the Gaza Strip. B, to inflict serious damage to Hamas's rocket-launching network. 3, C, to deliver a painful blow to Hamas and any other terror organization operating in Gaza. And D, to minimize damage to the Israeli home front. Israeli spokesman Mark Regev said, "We will act until we can achieve peace and quiet for those Israeli citizens who deserve to live in peace and quiet." All right, turn to page 378. Thousands of reserve troops have been mobilized, but Israelis do not want to initiate a ground operation in Gaza and have done everything possible to avoid one. The magnitude of the danger to millions of Israelis, however, may leave Israel with no other choice. Israel said the operation will end when Hamas stops its rockets fire. And that's basically the summary. Israel wants peace. Hamas wants to fire rockets. November 29th, 2012. United Nations General Assembly Resolution 67/19, upgrading Palestine to non-member observer state status in the United Nations, was adopted by the 67th session of the UN General Assembly, the date of the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People, and the 65th anniversary of the adoption of the General Assembly Resolution 181 on the future government of Palestine. 138 vote for it, 41 abstain, 9 vote against it. So following the successful passage of the 2012 United Nations status resolution that changed Palestine's status at the UN to that of an observer state. An observer state. A modern state is what they're saying. But you're just an observer. We haven't allowed you in the United Nations yet. On January 3rd, 2013, Abbas signed a presidential decree 1/2013, officially changing the name of the Palestinian Authority to the State of Palestine. Kind of crazy, but there it is. November 30th, 2012. In response to the UN approving the Palestinian UN bid for non-member observer state status, the Israeli government intercabinet announced that it approves the building of housing units in the E1 area connecting Jerusalem and Ma'ale Adumim. All right, here's the area that they're talking about. We'll start with the State of Israel. And this is the location of Jerusalem. So let's get in close. Now here, in this map, you can see little West Jerusalem is the tongue protruding into the map from the west side. That's West Jerusalem. Everything else surrounding that little tongue is East Jerusalem. And the divided up into Palestinian and Israeli settlements. Now in this area is the E1 zone between Ma'ale Adumim and West Jerusalem. And you notice, if you look on your map, well, I guess you don't have the map, sorry about that, this is an area that's not occupied by anybody. It's an open area. It's not utilized by Palestinians or Israelis. Now here's another map of the E1 zone. Again, between Ma'ale Adumim and Jerusalem, an area that is not occupied by Israelis or Palestinians. So Israel is saying, well, why don't we go ahead and put some housing units there? That was the whole complaint. And of course, the Palestinians are saying they're stealing our land. All right, well, let's summarize 2012, and then we'll go for a break. An annual survey by Shin Bet, or the Israeli Security Agency, concluded that in 2012, the number of terrorist attacks in the West Bank rose from 320 in 2011 to 578 in 2012. But it was accompanied by a decrease in the number of fatalities. So less people died, even though the number of attacks rose dramatically. During the same year, 282 attacks were carried out in Jerusalem, compared to 191 in 2011, so almost 100 attacks more in 2012. The increase in attacks is due in part to a 68% rise of attacks using Molotov cocktails. Molotov cocktail is a bottle filled with gasoline, and a gas-soaked rag is tied around the neck of the bottle. The rag is set afire, and then the bottle is tossed at a target. Of course, when the bottle breaks, the gasoline spills out and is ignited. So there was a 68% rise in attacks using that very unsophisticated but terrible weapon. However, the number of attacks involving firearms and explosives also grew by 42%, 37 attacks using firearms and explosives compared to 26 in 2011. All right, this brings us to page 378, to the bottom of the page, and 2013, but I see it's time for your break. So let's go ahead and take your break, and we'll be back in the year 2013. Okay, we're back from our break. So let's continue the first regathering. And we pick it up on page 378 with 2013. We'll jump all the way to April 1st, 2013, and a rather momentous event occurred in the life of the nation of Israel. Natural gas begins to flow from Tamar. 4 years after drilling began in the Tamar offshore field, some 80 kilometers off the Haifa shore, natural gas began flowing Saturday evening from the offshore platforms to Ashdod. So here is a map, a Google Eye view of the area. You can see the Mediterranean Sea, the big blue area on the left, Israel, the coast of Israel on the right with Haifa and Jerusalem. And now this is the Tamar area. This is the area where natural gas has been found off the coast of the state of Israel. And here are the natural gas fields that have been mapped. And you see in the center there is the Tamar field. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 actual fields in that area: Tamar, Tanin, Leviathan, Dolphin, and Dalit. But the gas began flowing from Tamar. And here is one of those offshore platforms that is drilling for the gas. So the gas began moving from this offshore platform to Ashdod. All right, page 379. The gas fields developers and politician hailed this as an historical day. The gas is now flowing through pipes to a production rig off the Ashdod shore and will begin to flow to the onshore storage facility on Sunday. The use of natural gas discovered in the Mediterranean Sea in the past few years is expected to assist the Israeli energy market and reduce energy costs. Development of the offshore field, which included 5 drilling projects and the laying of 2 150-kilometer-long pipelines at the sea, cost 3.2 billion shekels. Yitzhak Teshuvah, CEO of Delek — now Delek is the Israeli energy conglomerate, Delek — said Saturday, "The vision has turned into a reality. Today we are again emerging from slavery to freedom, from dependence upon foreign energy sources to independence with natural Israeli gas. This is a huge accomplishment for the Israeli market and the beginning of a new era." Very upbeat about that. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Saturday night, "This is an important day for the economy of Israel. On the holiday of freedom, we take an important step toward independence in the field of energy." Energy and Water Minister Silvan Shalom called the day Israel's energy-related Independence Day. So a very significant event for Israel. And the United States, we in the United States really ought to emulate them and strive for energy independence as well. All right, page 380. Israel's population grew tenfold since 1948. Just in time for Yom Ha'atzmuat, that's Israel Independence Day, Yom Ha'atzmuat, the Central Bureau of Statistics released data on Israel's population. On the state's 65th anniversary, Israel had over 8 million residents, nearly a tenfold increase over the number that lived there in 1948. A total of 8,018,000 people live in the state of Israel on Independence Day 2013. When the state was established on the 5th of the Hebrew month of Iyar in 1948, the number was a mere 806,000. Yes, so it is a 10 times increase. Today, there are 6,042,000 Jews, which is 75% of the country's population living in Israel, along with 1,658,000 Muslim and Christian Arabs. That's 20.7% of the population. The country also has an additional 318,000, that's 4% of the population, 318,000 residents classified as other, including non-Arab Christians and members of other religions. Israel's population grew by 138,000 since last Yom Ha'atzmuat, a growth rate of 1.8%. In 2011, it was announced that over 70% of the Jewish population were born in Israel, with more than half of them second-generation Israelis. In 1948, only 35% of the population were native Sabras. So now, in this year, in 2013, 70% of the Jewish population in the land were born in Israel. Quite an increase. The rise of the metropolitan area has been another important development in Israel over the past decades, the Central Bureau of Statistics said. In 1948, only one city, Tel Aviv-Jaffa, had more than 100,000 residents. Today, there are six cities with more than 200,000 residents: Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Tel Aviv-Jaffa, Haifa, Rishon LeZion, Ashdod, and Petah Tikva. June 4, 2013. Another very important statement made in behalf of Israel. South African lawmaker: Israel is not an apartheid state. And this is the accusation. This is the accusation that, latest accusation that the Palestinians have been putting forth against Israel. It is an apartheid state. Reverend Dr. Kenneth Mishu, an outspoken member of the South Africa Parliament, recently expressed ongoing frustration with accusations that Israel is an apartheid state, calling such claims an insult to what his own nation went through. And here is a photograph of the Reverend Dr. Kenneth Mishu. Kenneth Mishu from South Africa. Earlier this year, Dr. Mishu visited San Francisco just around the time that American universities, especially in California, and believe me, our little Bible book table was set up on the campus of the University of California, Irvine, and we witnessed this. Just around the time that American universities, especially in California, were swarming with anti-Israel propagandists whose new favorite ploy is to label Israel as a practitioner of apartheid against Arabs of the region. Quote, as a black South African who lived under apartheid, in my view, Israel cannot be compared to apartheid in South Africa, Mishu wrote in the San Francisco Examiner. Those who make the accusation expose their ignorance of what apartheid really is. Mishu explained that under South African apartheid, which was, quote, a legal system of segregation and oppression based on skin color, black people such as himself could not vote, freely travel, or hold high government positions. Furthermore, they were subjected to segregation everywhere, from public restrooms to schools to hospitals. All right, page 381, top of the page. In my numerous visits to Israel, I did not see any of the above, stated Mishu. Black, brown, white Jews, and the Arab minority mingle freely in all public places, universities, restaurants, voting stations, public transportation. All people have the right to vote. The Arab minority has political parties, serves in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, and holds positions in government ministries, the police force, and security services. In hospitals, Palestinian patients lie in beds next to Israeli Jews, and doctors and nurses are as likely to be Israeli, Arab, as Jewish. None of the above was legally permissible in apartheid South Africa. In short, Dr. Mishu, who heads the African Christian Democratic Party, said it was slanderous and deceptive to make such accusations against Israel, as doing so trivializes the word apartheid, minimizing and belittling the magnitude of racism and suffering endured by South Africans of color. In conclusion, he wrote that Israel, quote, Israel is a model of democracy, inclusion, and pluralism that can be emulated by many nations, particularly in the Middle East. Now, it's not the first time Dr. Mishu had spoken out on this issue. At an international gathering of legislators in Budapest on October 31st, 2011, he similarly called those who accuse Israel of being apartheid of being ignorant at best and purposely deceitful at worst. And that sums it up, the description of purposely deceitful. That is exactly what the Palestinians are trying to do when they label Israel as apartheid. Purposely deceitful. All right, let's move on to October 18th, 2013. Hamas admits being behind terror tunnel. The so-called military wing of Gaza's ruling Hamas terror group, the Izz al-Din al-Qassam Brigades, so again, this is part of Hamas, the Izz al-Din al-Qassam Brigades, has admitted that it masterminded the terror tunnel that was discovered leading from Gaza to an Israeli kibbutz. The group has admitted that the tunnel was meant to kidnap Israeli soldiers, according to the AFP. Israeli officials last Sunday revealed that IDF soldiers had uncovered a tunnel running from Gaza and extending for 2.5 kilometers, that's 1.5 miles, into kibbutz Ein HaShlosha. Several days after the discovery of this tunnel, Israeli security forces discovered a second one, believed to have been dug during last number's Pillar of Defense counterterrorism operation. Page 382. Daily newspaper Yediot Achronot wrote on Friday that Israel had known for over a year about the terror tunnel that Hamas was digging into its territory, but let Hamas leaders continue to pour resources into it. Sometimes, as part of the war of mines, Israel lets them invest money, rack their brains, waste human resources, and only towards the end of the digging does it hold up a stop sign, the paper's defense correspondent Alex Fishman wrote. The money should have gone into infrastructure, education, and health projects. So Israel will sometimes allow this to happen and then destroy it at the very end, after all those resources have been wasted. Well, here's some pictures of the Hamas terror tunnel. You can see it's a fairly sophisticated tunnel, concrete arches supporting the concrete walls and electrical wiring running down the tunnel. Here's a picture of Israeli soldiers inspecting the tunnel, the Hamas terror tunnel. And this picture, I include this picture to show you how deep they can be. These terror tunnels can be quite deep, but this one looks like it's about 50, 60 feet underground. A lot of earth had to be dug away to expose that portion of it, that part of it. All righty. Page 383, November 11th. Hamas vows to continue digging terror tunnels. On November 8th, 2013, Arud Sheva reported a Hamas spokesman vowing to continue to dig terror tunnels and encourage terror attacks. In addition, Arud Sheva carried this report regarding the exhumation and testing of Yasser Arafat's remains in an attempt to confirm his cause of death in 2004. Senior Palestinian Authority and Fatah leader Yibril Rajoub has appeared on PATV and accused the U.S. of being behind former PA chairman Yasser Arafat's supposed poisoning by Israel. Quote, "It's obvious that Israel wasn't alone," said Rajoub in an interview aired last week, adding that the U.S. was there. That fool known as Bush, that's George Bush, of course, took away Yasser Arafat's protection and gave Sharon, that's Prime Minister Sharon, the green light to liquidate Yasser Arafat. Despite medical testimony that Arafat died in 2004 of AIDS, he died of AIDS, but they don't want to admit that, recent investigations begun November 2012 found a moderate possibility of polonium poisoning. That's a radioactive material, polonium. The inconclusive early results were quickly jumped upon as the PA declared Israel was the only suspect in Arafat's assassination. Furthermore, the PA Minister of Religious Affairs previously on PATV claimed that, quote, "Jews poisoned Arafat like they poisoned Islam's prophet Muhammad." However, in contrast with the early accusations against Israel and the new accusation of the U.S., there have been other theories. Fahmy Shabani, former intelligence officer in the PA, suggested that PA leaders, including Palestinian Authority Chairman Mahmoud Abbas, were in fact behind the murder. Interestingly, he brings out the idea that people in Yasser Arafat's own inner circle killed him. The BBC reported the conclusions of the independent agencies analyzing the possibility that Arafat was poisoned with polonium-210. The Swiss team concluded that the results moderately supported the theory. The Russian examiners stated that their examination did not give sufficient evidence of polonium as the cause of death. So it is really a non-issue. But listen to what Arafat's widow had to say. Arafat's widow did not accuse anyone and stated that her husband had many enemies around the world. So she states it could have been anyone. Well, here is the tomb of Yasser Arafat. I believe it's in the Ramallah. And if you happen to visit that place, here is the tombstone and the Palestinian honor guard that marks the place, his final resting place. All right, November 24, 2013. Geneva Interim Agreement on Iranian Nuclear Program. On the 24th of November, 2013, an interim agreement was signed between Iran and the P5 plus one countries in Geneva, Switzerland. It consists of a short-term freeze of portions of Iran's nuclear program in exchange for decreased economic sanctions on Iran as the countries work toward a long-term agreement. Following is an excerpt from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's remarks today in the Knesset. So turn to page 384 for Benjamin Netanyahu's comments. He says, "I would be happy if I could join those voices around the world that are praising the Geneva Accord. It is true that the international pressure which we applied was partially successful and has led to a better result than was originally planned. But this is still a bad deal. It reduces the pressure on Iran without receiving anything tangible in return, and the Iranians who laughed all the way to the bank are themselves saying that this deal has saved them. I spoke last night with U.S. President Barack Obama. We agreed that an Israeli team led by National Security Advisor Yossi Cohen would leave us soon for the U.S. to discuss the permanent agreement with Iran. The agreement must lead to one result, the dismantling of Iran's military nuclear capability." Now note the next sentence. It's a long sentence. Mark it up. It's a mark it up moment. Prime Minister Netanyahu, "I remind you that only last week, during the talks, the leaders of Iran repeated their commitment to destroy the State of Israel. And I reiterate here today my commitment as Prime Minister of Israel to prevent them from achieving the ability to do so." That's the issue. Iran is now screaming for the destruction of Israel and doing what she can to bring that about. And we'll see what happens in the future. Well, this brings us now to July 8, 2014, in Operation Protective Edge. And Operation Protective Edge is a rather long event, rather long article. So I think this would be a good time to call it quits. We'll pick it up next session with Operation Protective Edge. So we'll see you then. Shalom.